that I'm a vampire?
Are you?
Luchov lay still a minute in his bed and stopped breathing, waiting for the other's answer. Are you asking? Do I kill men for their blood? Has my bite turned me into a monster? Have I myself been turned into a monster by a vampire's bite? Then I can only tell you, no. His answer wasn't entirely a lie, not yet. Luchov breathed again, began tossing in his bed as before, and he and Harry continued their tour of inspection around the rim of the glaring sphere gate. As they went, so the necroscope used a basic form of espionage telepathy to study the project's secret core, its awesome nucleus, where it was mirrored in the Russian scientist's subconscious mind. He saw it, that great spherical cavity carved in the mountain's solid rock, eaten out by unimaginable forces. And, in Luchov's mind, the enigmatic gate was the gravity-defying maggot at its centre, coiled into a perfect ball of matterless white light, motionless, still glutted on energy absorbed in the first moments of its creation. The gate, floating there like an alien chrysalis, with everything it contained waiting to break loose, to break out. But Harry also saw that certain things had changed. Some things, anyway. The last time he was here, or rather there, physically there, at its core, it had been like this. A spidery web of scaffolding had been built halfway up the curving wall at its perimeter, supporting a platform of timber flooring which surrounded the glaring gate or portal floating on thin air at the cavern's centre. The effect had been to make the sphere look like the planet Saturn, with a ring system composed of encircling timber floor. The cavern was little more than 40 metres in diameter, and the central sphere a little less than a quarter of that. There had been a gap of a few inches between the innermost timbers and the event horizon, which was the sphere's skin. Back up against the black, wormhole-riddled wall at the perimeter of the cavern, where the supporting scaffolding and stanchions were most firmly seated, three evenly spaced, twin-mounted Kolchov cannons had pointed their ugly muzzles almost point-blank at the blinding centre, ready at any moment's notice to discharge hot, sleeting steel at anything which might emerge from the glare. Closer to the centre, an electrified fence with a gate had been an additional precaution. But precautions against what? The answer to that was simple, against what appeared to be the denizens of hell. As to what the Perchovsk project had been originally, and how it mutated into what it was now? When the USA started work on its SDI program, the USSR thought to answer with Perchovsk. If America's aim was to knock out 90% of incoming Russian missiles, then the Reds must discover a way to terminate or otherwise render inefficient 100% of missiles having origin in the USA. The answer was to have a screen of energy, several in fact, which would enclose the Soviets' heartland or large vital parts of it under an impenetrable umbrella. A team of top-ranked scientists were quickly assembled, and in the depths of the Perchovsk ravine, an amazing subterranean complex was blasted and hewn out of the mountain itself. A dam was constructed in the ravine. Its turbines would supply sufficient hydroelectric power to drive the complex and supplement the energy of its atomic pile. Working furiously, the Soviet task force completed the Perchovsk project in short order and with nothing to spare in what had been a very tight schedule. Except that perhaps the schedule had been just a little too tight. And then the device had been tested. It was tested just once, and went disastrously wrong. Mechanical failure. Energies which should have fanned out and been dispersed across a great arc of the sky were turned back in their tracks, deflected downwards into the core of the project. In the pile, the Perchovsk project ate its own heart. It ate flesh and blood and bone, plastic and rock and steel, nuclear fuel and the atomic pile itself. For a second, maybe 2 seconds, three, it was ultimately voracious, so much so that finally it ate itself. And when it was over, the shining sphere gate hung in the thin air where the pile had been, and the laboratories and levels all around had been reduced to so much magmas. That was what Director Luchov had termed those monstrous regions in the vicinity of the central cavity and gate. The magmas levels, made monstrous by what had occurred in them at the time of the blowback, when flesh and rock and whatever else had been gathered together and fused or moulded into this or that incredible, unthinkable shape, like so much plasticine. Men reversed so that their innards hung outwards had become one with the rock walls, and closer to the centre, where they had been incinerated by the heat of the blowback, there they'd left their twisted, alien impressions scorched into the blackened rock. Pompeii, in a fashion, is similar to look upon, but there in the ashes and lava, at least the figures are still recognisably human. After that, it had soon become apparent just what the sphere was. The fact that the failed experiment had blown a hole through the wall of this universe into another, which lay parallel, and the sphere was the doorway, the portal, the gate. But it was a weird kind of gate. Anything goes through it, it couldn't come back. Likewise, for anything that came through the other side from the parallel world of Sunside and Starside. And the trouble with Starside, of course, was that it was a source of vampirism, the home of the Vampiri. Things had come through the other side, which, by the grace of God or by chance, good fortune, had been destroyed before they could carry their lethal taint, the plague of vampirism, into the outside world. But such had been their horror that men just couldn't face up to them. Hence the flamethrowers everywhere evident, where in other secret establishments one might expect to find fire extinguishers. Hence the fear, which had lived and breathed and occasionally held its breath in Perchosk. The fear which lived here even now. Even now, yes. It was different, Harry observed, but not that different. For one thing, the wooden floorboards of the Saturn Rings platform had been replaced by these steel plates, radiating outwards from the sphere like giant fish scales. The Katashevs have gone too, leaving the gate surrounded at its own height by a system of ominous-looking sprinklers, and higher up the curving wall of the cavern, on platforms of their own, where the great glass carboys, which contain the liquid agent for their sprinkling system, many gallons of highly corrosive acid. The steel plates of the ring sloped slightly downwards towards the centre, so that any spilled acid would run that way. Below the sphere gate, central on the magma's floor, a huge glass tank served as a catchment area for the acid when its work was done. Its work, of course, would be to blind, incapacitate, and rapidly reduce to fumes anything that should come through from the other side, for after the last grotesque emergence of a Vampiri warrior creature, Viktor Luchov had known that exploding steel or a team of men with conventional flamethrowers just wouldn't be enough. Not for that sort of thing. What had been enough was the fail-safe system, which was in use at the time, which poured thousands of gallons of explosive fuel into the core and then ignited it. Except it had also reduced the complex to a shell. Since when? Why didn't you get out then? Harry inquired, when he'd seen everything he needed to see. Why didn't you just quit the place, close it up?
Oh, we did, briefly, Luchov answered,
blinking rapidly where he peered at his dream visitor in the glare of the gate.
We got out. Sealed off the tunnels, filled all the horizontal ventilation and service shafts into the ravine with concrete, built a gigantic steel door onto the old entrance like a door on a bank vault. Why, we did a good job on the Polchesk project, as they'd later do on the reactor in Chernobyl. And then we had people sitting out there in the ravine with their senses, listening to it, until we realized that we just couldn't stand the silence.
Harry knew what he meant. The horror at Chernobyl couldn't reactivate itself. It wasn't likely to become sentient. But if sentient minds could plug the holes at Perchosk, others, however alien, might always unplug them.
We had to know, to be able to see for ourselves, that all was well down here, Luchov continued. At least until we could deal with it on a more permanent basis.
Oh? Harry was keenly interested. Deal with it permanently? Will you explain? And Luchov might have done just that, except Harry had allowed himself to become just a fraction too intense, too real. And suddenly the project director had known that this was more than an ordinary dream. Starting awake in his austere, cell-like room, the Russian jerked upright in his bed and saw Harry sitting there, staring at him with his eyes like clots of fluorescent blood in the room's darkness. Then, remembering his dream and panting his shock where he pressed himself to the bar steel wall, Luchov gasped,
"Harry Kiyor, it is you! You liar!"
Again, Harry knew what he meant, but he shook his head. "I told you, no lie, Victor. I haven't killed men for their blood. I've created no vampires. I wasn't myself infected that way."
"That was maybe," the other gasped, "but you are a vampire."
Harry smiled, however terribly. "Look at me," he said, his voice very soft, almost warm, even reasonable. "I mean, I can hardly deny it, can I?" And he leaned himself a little closer to Luchov. The Russian was as Harry remembered him. His skin might be a shade more sallow, his eyes more feverish, but basically he was the same man. Small, thin, he was badly scarred, and the hair was absent from the left half of his face and yellow-veined skull. But however vulnerable Luchov might seem, Harry knew that in fact he was a survivor. He had survived the awful accident which created the gate, survived all the things which subsequently came through it, even survived the final Holocaust. Yes, survived everything. So far, anyway. Luchov blanched under the necroscope scrutiny and panted that much faster. He prayed that the steel wall would absorb him safely within itself, maybe to expel him in the cell next door, away from this man. But Luchov had faced a vampire before, and even the thought of it was terrifying. Finally, he forced out words.
"Why are you here?"
Harry's gaze was unwavering. He watched the yellow veins pulsing rapidly under the scar tissue's skin of Luchov's seared skull, and answered, "Oh, you know why well enough, Victor. I'm here because of what E-Branch told you, or caused you to be told, that I'm obliged to abandon this world, and in order to do so must use the Perchos Gate. But no big deal. Why, I should have thought you'd be glad to see the last of me."
"Oh, we would. We would,"
Luchov eagerly agreed, nodding until droplets of sweat flew.
"It's just that...
Harry inclined his head a little on one side and smiled his awful smile again. "Go on." But Luchov had already said too much.
"If what you say is true,"
he babbled, trying to change the subject,
"that as yet you've harmed no one, I mean...
"Are you asking me not to harm you?" Harry deliberately yawned, politely hiding the indelicate gape behind his hand, but not before he'd let the Russian glimpse the length and serrated edges of his teeth, and not without displaying the hand's talons. "What, for the sake of my reputation? Every esper in Europe and possibly even further afield baying for my blood? But I have to be a good boy. Fair's fair, Victor. Now, why don't you just tell me what E-Branch told you lot, and what they've asked you to do? Oh, yes, and what measure, what permanent solution, they could possibly be to this Frankenstein monster you created here at Perchosk."
"But I can't! Don't tell you any of those things," Luchov whined, cringing against the steel wall.
"So despite all you've been through, you're still a true brainwashed son of Mother Russia, eh?" Harry grimaced and gave a mocking snort. Luchov shook his head.
"No, just a man, a member of the human race."
"But one who believes everything people tell him, right?"
"What do my eyes tell me, certainly."
The necroscope's patience was at an end. He leaned closer still, grabbed Luchov's wrists in a steel claw, and hissed,
"You argue well, Victor. Perhaps you really should have been one of the Vampiri."
And at last the project director could see his worst nightmare taking shape before his eyes. The metamorphosis of a man into a potential plague, and knew that he might all too easily become the next carrier. But he still had a card left to play.
You defy every scientific principle," he babbled. "You come and go in that weird way of yours, but did you think I had forgotten? Did you think I wouldn't remember and take precautions? Better go now, Harry, before they burst in through the door there and burn you to a crisp."
"What?" Harry let go of him, jerked himself away from him. Luchov snatched back the covers of his bed and showed the necroscope the button attached to the steel frame. The button which he had pressed, how long ago, and whose tiny red light was flashing even now. And Harry knew that, however unwittingly, still he'd been betrayed by his own vampire. For this was a failure of his dark side. The thing within him had wanted to be seen, to take ascendancy, to do this thing its own way and frighten the answers out of Luchov. Yes, and then possibly kill him. If Harry had fought it down, then he might simply have plucked the answers right out of the scientist's mind. But too late for that now. Not too late to fight back, however, and drive the hidden thing to the ground, beat it back into subservience. He did so, and Luchov saw that he was just a man again. Sobbing, the Russian said,
I thought that you would kill me.
Not me, Harry answered, as running footsteps sounded from outside. Not me, it. And yes, it might have killed you. But damn you, you trusted me, Victor. And did I let you down? All right, so the flesh and blood me has changed, but the real me, I'm still the same.
But it is different now, Harry,
Luchov answered, suddenly aware that he diverted whatever.
Surely you can't see that. I'm not doing anything for myself anymore. Not even for Mother Russia. It's for the human race. For all of us.
They were banging on the door now, voices shouting. Listen! Harry's face was as earnest and as human as the Russian had ever seen it. Or it would be, but for those hellish eyes. But now E-Branch and your Russian organization too, if they're worth their salt, must know I only want out. So why can't they just let me go? Shots sounded from the corridor, 10 or more in rapid succession, hammer blows of hot lead that slammed into the lock on the steel panel door and shattered its works to scrap metal.
But... are you telling me you don't know?
Luchov saw only Harry now, only the man.
Are you saying you don't understand?
Maybe I do, Harry answered. I'm not sure. But right now you're the only one who can confirm it. And so Luchov confirmed it.
But they're not worried about you, Harry,
he said as the door was slammed back on its hinges and light flooded in.
They're only worried that one day you might come back. And what you might try to bring with you.
Scared men crowded the doorway. One cradled a flamethrower, its flickering muzzle pointing directly at Luchov.
Don't!
The director screamed, ramming himself into the corner and covering his face with frail, fluttering hands.
For Christ's sake, don't! He's gone! He's gone!
They stood there in the doorway, smokily silhouetted in cordite stench, looking round the stark cubicle. And finally one of them asked,
"Who has gone, director?"
And another said,
"Has the director been dreaming?"
Luchov collapsed on his bed, sobbing. Oh, how he wished he'd only been dreaming. But no, he hadn't. Not all of it, anyway, for he could still feel the pressure on his wrist where the necroscope had gripped him, and he could still feel those terrible eyes burning on his face and in his mind. Oh, yes. Harry Keogh had been here, and pretty soon he'd be back. But the director also knew that unless he was hugely mistaken, Harry had only learned part of what he came to learn. The next time he came, the rest of it would be waiting for him. But the next time could be any time as of right now.
"Switch it on!" he gasped.
"Eh?"
A scientist hastily, unceremoniously pushed by the rest and squeezed himself into the gap beside Luchov's bed.
"The disc? Did you say we've to switch it on?"
"Yes."
Luchov grasped his arm.
"And do it now, Dmitri. Do it right now."
Then Luchov lay back, gasping and clutched his throat.
"I can't breathe. I can't breathe."
"Out,"
Dmitri Kolchov ordered at once with a wave of his arm.
"Out, all of you. Let's have some air in here."
But as the men filed out...
"Wait!"
Luchov held out a claw-like hand after them.
"You with the flamethrower. Wait right outside. And you with the shotgun. It is loaded? Silver shot?"
"Of course, director."
The man looked puzzled. What use to have it if it wasn't loaded?
"And is there a grenadier with you, with grenades?"
Luchov was quieter now, steadier.
"Yes, director,"
came the answer from outside. Luchov nodded, and his Adam's apple wobbled a little as he gulped down air.
Then you three, all of you, wait for me outside, and from now on don't let me out of your sight."
He swung his legs wearily to the floor, then noticed Dmitri Kolchov standing there, staring at him.
"Director, I..."
Kolchov started to speak.
"Now!"
Luchov screamed at him.
"Man, are you fucking deaf? Didn't you hear me? I said switch on the disc right now. Then report to the duty room and get me Moscow on the hotline."
"Moscow?" Pallid now and shrinking a little, Kolchov backed out of the small room.
"Gorbachev!"
Luchov rasped.
"Gorbachev and none other, for there's no one else who can order what comes next."
Chapter 2. A Thing Alone, Starside, The Dweller. The Necroscope knew that there was very little time left, and certainly none to waste. The Soviets had worked out some final solution to the Perchosk problem, which meant that he had to be through the gate before they could put it into effect. He went to Detroit, and just after 6:20 p.m. found a bike garage and showroom on the point of closing. The last tired employee was locking up. The next to last, a black forecourt attendant, had just this minute put away his broom, washed his hands, and was sauntering away from the garage down the evening street. Marvelous chrome-plated machines stood in a glittering chorus line behind the semi-reflective plate glass.
"The Necroscope, right?"
said the dead-speak voice in Harry's mind after he'd used a Mobius door to get into the showroom. It surprised him, for the dead weren't much for talking to him these days.
"I mean, you'd have to be the bogeyman,"
whoever it was continued,
"'cause I can hear you thinking."
"You have me at a disadvantage," Harry answered, polite as ever, at the same time examining the chain which passed through the spoked front wheels of the parade of gleaming motorcycles, securing them.
"I have your what? Oh, yeah, you don't know me, right. Well, I was an angel."
Dead speak occasionally conveys more than is said. With regards to angels, Harry would no longer be surprised to learn that there really were such creatures, and especially in the Mobius Continuum, but on this occasion he saw that the angel in question wore no such halo. "A Hell's Angel?" Harry stood on the chain and hauled with both arms, exerting furious vampiric strength, until a link came apart with a sound like a pistol shot. "But didn't you have a name?"
"Hey, whoa, man!"
And the angel whistled appreciatively.
"Look, I bet you can leap tall buildings too, right? Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Shit, no, it's the ever-loving, chain-breaking, dead-waking Necroscope."
He grew quieter.
"My name? It was Pete. Pretty shitty handle, right? Here, Petey, Petey, here, Petey. Sounds like a fucking budgie. So I used my chapter name, The Vampire. But I see you have your own problems."
Harry took a Harley Davidson off its stand and backed it out of the line of bikes towards the rear of the showroom. But the last employee had heard the gunshot of the snap chain and was working his way back through a series of locked doors.
"Pete seems a good enough name to me," said Harry. "So what are you doing here?" "It's where I hung out,"
the angel told him.
"I never could afford one of the really big babies, but I come down here and look 'em over all the time. This place was a shrine, a church, and these Harleys were its high-powered priests."
"How did you die?" Harry turned the key in the ignition and the bike thundered into life, each pulse of each fat piston almost individually audible.
"One night, me and my pillion pussy had a fight,"
the angel answered.
"Randy Mandy split, so later, me and the machine, we were both full of high octane. The booze caught up with us about the same time as we clocked the big 100. Ran out of road on a bend, piled into a filling station, crunched a pump. We burned, me and the bike, both in a white-hot geyser. What was left of my body blew away in the wind, but me, I gravitated here."
"Pete," said Harry, "I always wanted to ride one of these things, but never seemed to find the time."
"You don't know how?"
"In one," Harry nodded. "I mean, I can learn the hard way, or take a little expert advice, right? So, fancy a ride?"
"Me?"
"Who else?"
"Hoo-hoo-ah!"
And Harry could almost feel him right there on the saddle where it arse-hooked at the back. Indeed, their minds were one as Harry revved her up and up and up and then let her rip in smoking tires and shrieking gears straight at the wall of glass. Meanwhile, the last employee had reopened the final door and entered the showroom, and was now backed up against the giant display window, right in Harry's way. Spread-eagled, the man mouthed a silent gaping scream as the big bike snaked towards him. He knew he'd be cut to ribbons, he and this maniac rider both, and didn't know which way to jump. Closing his eyes and saying his prayers, he slid down the glass even as the bellowing monster bore down on him, and passed right through him, and was gone. As the noise subsided, he opened his eyes, first a crack, then all the way. The Harley-Davidson and rider were no longer there. There were skid marks, blue exhaust smoke, even the roar of the engine, slowly echoing into the silence, but no bike and no rider, and the plate glass was still in one piece.
Haunted, the man thought, before he passed out. Christ, I've always known it. This place is haunted to hell.
He was right and he was wrong. The place had been haunted, but no longer, for Pete the Vampire Biker was now with Harry Keogh, and like Harry, he wouldn't be back. Harry coasted through the Mobius Continuum to Zakynthos, conjured a door and blazed out through it at 40 onto the uneven surface of a starlight Greek island road. An inexperienced rider, he might have come a grief right there and then, but Pete the Biker was in his mind and his hands, and the huge machine stayed upright and steady on the potholed tarmac. Zek met the necroscope on the white steps which wound to her door, but she had spoken to him moments earlier.
Penny's awake. She's been drinking coffee, a lot.
My fault, Harry had answered. We did a little celebrating, a moving out party. And he thought of his place near Bonnyrigg, Edinburgh. Housewarming with a difference, yes.
Well,
said the Hell's Angel, seeing Zek mirrored in Harry's mind.
Is this your pillion, pussy?
But of course, his exclamation and question were dead speak, and Zek couldn't hear them, or even know he was here at all. No, it isn't, Harry spoke only to Pete. She's just a good friend. Anyway, mind your business, and your mouth. Penny joined Zek and Harry even as they touched hands. She came ghosting to the door and smiled, however tiredly, however eerily, when she saw that the necroscope had returned. And there in the Greek night, Zek saw the cores of Penny's eyes glowing red as a moth's, where they reflected the light of the lamp over the door. As for Harry's eyes, Zek avoided looking at them. In any case, there was no need, and no need to say anything out loud. Not when their minds were touching. Zek, he said, I owe you.
We all owe you, she answered. Every one of us.
Not any more. You've squared it for the rest. Goodbye, Harry. She leaned forward and kissed his lips. Just a man's lips for the moment, but cold. He led Penny through the trees to the big bike, and mounting up, looked back. Zek stood in a lamplight and starlight and waved. The Harley-Davidson's lights cut a swathe under the trees, picking out the track back to the road. Zek heard the roar of the engine pick up to a howl, saw the headlights cutting the night, held her breath. Then, the engine noise was only a receding echo doing a drum roll along the hills, and the headlight beam was gone like it had never existed. Are your eyes closed? Harry asked over his shoulder.
Yes,
she answered through a whisper. Then keep them that way, tight closed, until I tell you to open them. Hurling the big bike through the Mobius Continuum, with Penny and Pete the Vampire riding pillion, Harry headed for the Perchosk Gate. He knew exactly, indeed precisely, where the gate was. Mobius equations flickered across the screens of his metaphysical mind, opening and closing an endless curve of doors as he went. But when the doors began to warp and waver, he knew he was almost there. It was an effect of the gate, to bend the Mobius Continuum like a black hole bends light. A moment later, Harry guided the bike through the last fluxing, disintegrating door and hurtled out of the Mobius Continuum onto the perimeter of the steel disc surrounding the gate. And Viktor Luchov saw it all, even as it happened. At the very rim, where the plates of the disc were covered in rubber 3 inches thick, the project director was conversing with a group of scientists. The perimeter had been made safe, roped off with non-conductive plastic-coated nylon. The disc not only carried a lethal voltage, but was now linked to the sprinkler system. Fat white and blue sparks danced as Harry's huge, powerful machine came roaring off the Mobius strip to erupt into this space-time. The Screaming Eagle's Dunlops were wide, heavy, and of the very best rubber, but the sudden shock of the bike's 570-plus pounds jarred fish-scaled plates together in a crackling and hum of electrical discharge. Blue energies skittered across the disc like snakes of lightning, adding to the throaty chaos of snarling pistons in the cathedral acoustics of the spherical cavern. And overhead, the acid floodgates were opened. The Necroscope's intuitive Mobius math was in top form. He had calculated well, and after all, what could possibly go wrong in something slightly less than the space of a single second? Walking round that central cavern with Luchov in the director's mind, he'd seen no guns there. The acid sprinkler outlets had been maybe 20 feet above the disc. They'd take a little time to activate and fill before they could commence spraying. He should be into the sphere gate and gone before the first droplets smoked murderously down onto the steel plates. And yet, even as he emerged into the glare of the cavern and his tires had shrieked on the plates where they tried to find purchase, even then he'd known that something was wrong. Not with his figures, but with the plan itself, with what he already knew of the plan, with what he'd already seen of it in action. For he had seen something of it, yes, when he'd visited Faethor in future time. His scarlet-tinged neon line of life, turning aside from its futureward thrust, shooting off at right angles and disappearing into a brilliant burst of red and blue fire as it left this dimension of space and time and raced for Starside. But only as it, that solitary lifeline, one lifeline, departed. Harry himself, Harry alone, without Penny. Slowing from 40 to 30 miles per hour, while the bike yawned and his tyres found purchase, Harry remembered a vastly important rule. Never try to read the future, for that can be a devious thing. But he had taken even this temporary deceleration into account, and even so the timing was still only a second, one tick of a clock. So what was wrong? The answer was simple. Penny was wrong. Had she once obeyed him? Had she once obeyed his instructions to the letter? No, never. She might be enthralled to him, in love with him, fascinated by him, but she didn't go in fear of him. He was her lover, not her master, and, in her innocence, Penny had been inquisitive and vulnerable. "Don't open your eyes," he had said. But being Penny, she had. Open them as they shot through the Mobius door into Perchosk. Open them in time to see the glaring Cyclops eye gate looming where the bike skidded, fish-tailed and rocketed towards it. And seeing, knowing they were going to crash, she reacted. Of course they were going to crash, crash right through, which was the whole plan and shouldn't be her concern. If time wasn't of the essence, he might have explained all of that to her. All of which flashed across the Necroscope's mind in the split second that Penny screamed and let go his waist to cover her eyes, and his rear suspension bucking like a bronco to absorb the shuddering of the steel plates, and just exactly like a bronco ass hooking the gasping girl into an aerial somersault. In the next split second he ruptured the gate's skin and shot through, but on his own. A thing alone. Or at best, with only Pete the Vampire Biker hanging on behind.
Shit!
Pete's dead speak howled in Harry's mind.
Necroscope, you've lost your pillion, pussy!
Harry saw it in his mirror, looked out through the gate's skin and watched Penny come down in dreadfully slow motion onto the plate of the disc. He saw the languid flash of lightning that stiffened her limbs to a crucifix, laced her hair and clothes with webs of blue fire, and spun her body like a giant, coruscating Catherine wheel. He saw the acid rain come down and the curtain of hissing vapour which at once went up, saw Penny turn wet and black and red, skittering like a flounder on her back where her skin peeled open or was eaten away, saw her rumba roller skated this way and that across the steel plates on vibrating molecules of her own boiling blood, like droplets of water flicked into a greasy smoking hot pan. She had been dead, of course, from the first flash of blue fire, and so felt nothing of it. But Harry did. He felt the absolute horror of it, and he sucked in his breath, as at last the current glued her to the steelfish scales, where acid and fire both worked on her, turning her to ashes, tar, smoke, and stink. And there was nothing he could do, not even Harry Keogh, for he was through the gate and no way back. But there are certain mercies. Her single silent telepathic shriek had failed to reach him, for he'd already been over the threshold and into another world. Likewise, her deadspeak, if she was using it now, it was shut out by the gate. The necroscope wanted to die, right here, right now. He could happily, unhappily die. But that wasn't the way of the thing inside him. And Pete the Angel wasn't about to let it happen either. Between them, they closed Harry down, turned him to ice, froze him out. Lolling there, emotionless, mindless, vacant in the saddle of the Screaming Eagle, he wasn't riding the bike anymore, but they were, and they rode it all the way to Starside. When Harry recovered, he was a full mile out on the boulder plain, seated on a rock beside the now silent Harley-Davidson. The big machine stood there, silvered by the full moon and ghostly starlight. It had seemed awesome enough in a showroom on Earth, but here on Starside it was utterly and literally alien. The bike was alien, but Harry wasn't. Vampiri, he belonged here. A picture of Penny surfaced out of the memory's scarlet swirl. He remembered, drew breath to howl and choke on it, then clenched his fists and closed his red eyes for long moments, until he'd driven her out of his mind forever. The effort left him limp as a wet rag, but it had to be done. Everything Penny had been, everything anyone had been, was a dimension away and entirely irretrievable. There was no going back and no bringing her back.
"Bad vibes, man,"
said Pete the biker, but quietly.
"What now, Harry? We done riding?"
Harry stood up, straightened up and looked around. It was sundown and in the south there was no gold on the jagged peaks of the mountains. East lay the low, tumbled tumuli of shattered Eries, the fallen stacks of the Vampiri. Only one remained intact, an ugly column of dark stone and grey bone more than a kilometre high. It was, or had been, the Lady Karen's, but that was a long time ago, and Karen was dead now. Southwest, up into the mountains, that was where the Dweller had his garden. The Dweller, yes, Harry Jr., with his travellers and trogs, all secure in the haven he'd built for them, except the Dweller was a vampire, and the battle with the Vampiri lay 4 long years in Starside's past, so that Harry wondered, is my son still ascendant, or has the vampire in him finally taken control? His thoughts were deadspeak, of course, and Pete the Angel answered them.
Why don't we just go and see, man?
The last time I was here, we argued, my son and I, and he gave me a hard time, but, and he shrugged, I suppose he has to know sooner or later that I'm back if he doesn't know it already.
So let's go.
Pete was eager to ride.
Just climb aboard the old Screaming Eagle and start her up, man.
But the necroscope shook his head.
I don't need the bike, Pete. Not anymore.
The ex-angel was cast down.
Hey, that's right. You've got your own form of transport. But what about me?
Harry thought about it a while, then gave a wan smile. And it was a measure of his strength that he still had it in him to smile. Pete the biker read his deadspeak thoughts, of course, and whooped wildly.
Necroscope, do you mean it?
He was breathless with excitement.
Sure,
said Harry. Why not? And they got aboard the big bike. They turned her around, found a good straight stretch of hard-packed boulder-free earth, and took her up to a ton, and it was as if a primal beast bellowed in the starlight silence of Starside. Then, still howling 100 and waving a tail of dust 1/2 mile long, Harry conjured a Mobius door and they shot through, followed by a future time door, which they likewise crashed. And now they rode into the future with a great many blue and green, and, Harry noted, even a few red lifelines. The blues were travellers, the greens were betrogs, and the reds...
vampires?
Pete picked the thought out of his mind.
Looks like it,
said Harry, sighing. But Pete only laughed like a crazy man.
My kind of people,
he yelled, and on they rode for a little while, until Harry said,
Pete, here's where I get off. You mean she's all mine?
Forever and ever, and you needn't ever stop.
Pete didn't know how to thank him, so he didn't try. Harry opened a pass-time door, then paused a while before crossing the threshold and watched the big Harley rocketing away from him into the future. Eventually, he heard the angel's whooping cry come echoing back.
Yee-haw!
But at least Pete was happy now, and then Harry went back to Starside and the garden. The necroscope stood at the forward edge of the garden, his hands resting on the low stone wall there, and looked down on Starside. Somewhere between here and the old territories of the Vampiri, where the broken remains of their eyries now lay in shattered disarray, the sphere gate, this end of the space-time handle, the dimension warp whose alternative extension lay in Perchosk, would be lighting up the stony plain in its painful white glare. Harry fancied he could see something of its light even from here, a ghostly shimmer way down there in the far grey foothills. He and the incorporeal Pete had come out of the Starside gate onto the Big Bight, come through the aching dazzle of the grey hole from Perchosk and out onto its boulder plain, but Harry remembered very little of that. He did remember the last time he was here, though, however, which strangely felt more real to him than all that had gone between, probably because he now desired to forget all that had gone between. He turned his head more directly northward and gazed out across the leagues of Starside's vast unknown to the curve of the horizon, lying dark blue and emerald green under the fleeting moon, glittering stars, and the writhing allure of auroral borealis. That way lay the Icelands, where the sun never shone and into which the doomed, forsaken and forgotten of the Vampiri had been banished since time immemorial. Scythus, too, after the defeat of the Vampiri and the destruction of their eyries in the Battle of the Dweller's Garden, and he remembered how Scythus had sped north aboard a huge manta flyer in the peace and silence of the aftermath. Harry and the Lady Karen had spoken to Scythus before he exiled himself. Unrepentant even then, the vampire lord had openly lusted after Karen's body, and even more so after the Dweller's and his father's hearts. But he'd lusted in vain, at that time anyway. As for the necroscope, he had his own use for the Lady Karen, for just like his son, she had a vampire in her. If he could exorcise Karen's nightmare creature, perhaps he could also cure the Dweller. He starved Karen in her eyrie, using the blood of a piglet to lure her vampire out of her, then burned the thing before it could escape back into her body. But after that, things had not gone according to plan, and the rest of it was still seared on the screen of his memory. She came to him in a dream, stood over him in her most revealing white gown, and turned his triumph to ashes.
"Can't you see what you have done to me?" she said. "I, who was Vampiri, am now a shell. For when one has known the power, the freedom, the magnified emotions of the vampire, what is there after that? I pity you, for I know why you did what you've done, and also that you've failed."
And then she was gone. He woke up and searched for her in all the rooms, on all the many levels of the eyrie, and could not find her. Eventually, he went out onto a high bone balcony and looked down, and saw Karen's white dress lying crumpled on the scree more than a kilometre below. No longer entirely white, but red too, and Karen had been inside it. Harry shook himself, came out of his reverie, deliberately turned his back on Starside and the scars it had given him, and looked at the garden, which now he saw was not entirely as he remembered it. A garden? Well, yes, but not the well-tended garden he had known. And the greenhouses, the hillside dwelling places of the travellers, the hot springs and speckled trout pools. There was green algae on the pools. The polythene panels in many of the greenhouses were torn and flapping in cold air eddies out of Starside. The dwelling houses, especially Harry Junior's, showed signs of disrepair, where tiles were missing from the roofs, windows broken, and central heating pipes from the thermal pools cracked and spilling their contents out upon the open ground, so that the radiators went without.
"Not the same, Harry Herlander, is it?" said a deep, sad, growling voice from close at hand, if not in those words exactly.
but the necroscope's telepathy had filled in the bits which his ears had failed to recognize. It's easy to be a linguist when you're also a telepath. Harry turned his face to the man approaching him, jiggling along the lee of the wall. As he did so, the other noted his gaunt grey flesh and crimson eyes and paused. "Hello there, Lardis." The necroscope nodded, his own voice as deep and deeper than the other's. "I hope that shotgun's not for me." He wasn't joking. If anything, he might be threatening.
"For the Dweller's father."
Lardis looked at the weapon in his hands, as if seeing it for the first time, in something of a surprise. He shuffled a little awkwardly, like a boy caught in contemplation of some small crime, and said,
"Hardly that. But..."
And again the traveller chief looked at Harry's eyes, and this time narrowed his own.
"Whatever you've been and whatever you've done since last you were here, Harry Hellander, I see you've known hard times."
Finally, he averted his gaze, glanced here and there all about the garden, then down onto Starside.
"Aye, and hard times here too, and more still to come, I fear."
Harry studied the man and asked, "Hard times? Won't you explain?" Lardis Ledescu was Romani. In this world, on Earth, anywhere, there would be no mistaking the gypsy in him. He was maybe 5'8" tall, built like a crag, and looked of one age with the necroscope. In fact, he was a lot younger, but Starside and the Vampiri had taken their toll. In contrast to his squat design, he was very agile, and not alone in body. His intelligence was patent in every brown wrinkle of his expressive face. Open and frank, Lardis's round face was framed in dark flowing hair, in which streaks of grey were now plainly visible. He had slanted bushy eyebrows, a flattened nose, and a wide mouth full of strong, if uneven, teeth. His brown eyes held nothing of malice, but were careful, thoughtful, penetrating.
"Explain," said Lardis, coming no closer. "But isn't all of this explanation enough?"
He opened his arms expansively, as if to enclose the entire garden. "I've been away for 4 years, Lardis," Harry reminded him, but not exactly in those words. He made automatic conversions. Time on Sunside and Starside was not measured in years, but in those periods between sunup, when the barrier peaks turn gold, and sundown, when auroras dance in the northern skies. "When I left this place and returned to the Helllands," he did not say, "after my son had crippled and banished me," for he'd read in Lardis's mind that he knew nothing of that, "we just won a resounding victory over the Vampiri. The sun had burned the Dweller very badly, but he was well on the road to complete recovery. The future of you and your traveller tribe, and the Dweller's Trogs too, seems secure. So what happened? Where is everyone? And where's the Dweller?"
"In good time," Lardis nodded slowly. "In good time."
And in a little while, frowning,
"When I saw you come here,"
he seemed to have changed the subject,
"when you appeared here in that way of yours, as once the Dweller was wont to appear,"
past tense, Harry contrived to hide a small start,
"well, I knew it was you, obviously. I remember how you looked, you, Zack, and Jazz, as if all of that were yesterday. Yes, I remembered the good times in the days immediately after the battle here in the garden. Then, approaching you, I saw your eyes and knew you were a victim no less than the Dweller in that earlier time. And because you are Harry Wolfson's father, his natural father, I suppose also because I carry this shotgun loaded with silver from your son's armory, I wasn't afraid of you. For after all, I am Lardis Ledisky, whom even the Vampiri respected in some small part."
"In some large part," Harry said at once. "Don't sell yourself short." "So what are you trying to say, Lardis?"
"I am wondering,"
the other began to answer, paused and sighed.
"The Dweller, when lucid, had mentioned..."
"When lucid? Now what the hell was that?" Harry would look inside Lardis's head, but something warned him not to take on too much. "Yes," he prompted.
"Is it possible?"
Lardis jerked the shotgun shut across his arm, thus loading it, its twin barrels pointing straight at Harry's heart.
"That you are their advanced guard?"
The necroscope conjured a Mobius door directly under his own feet and fell through it, and in the next moment rose up out of another door behind the traveller chief. The echo of the double blast was still bouncing between the higher crags. A whiff of cordite stench drifted on the air. Lardis was cursing very vividly and swinging the double barrels of his weapon left and right through a 180-degrees arc. Harry touched him on the shoulder, and as Lardis crouched down and spun on his heels, took the gun from him. He propped the weapon against the wall, narrowed his eyes and tilted his head on one side a little, perhaps warningly, and growled, "Let's walk, Lardis, but this time let's try to be a little more forthcoming." The gypsy was built like a bull. For a moment he remained in his half-crouch, eyes slitted, arms reaching. But finally he changed his mind. Harry was a vampire. Go up against him, one might as well hurl oneself from a high place, which would be a much quicker, far less painful death. But this time, no longer distracted by the gun, Harry read his thoughts. "No need to die, Lardis," he said as softly as possible, "and no need to kill. I'm no one's vanguard. Now, will you tell me what has happened? What is happening here? And take the shortest route about it."
"Many things have happened," Lardis grunted, catching his breath, "and many more will happen. That is, if the Dweller's premonitions, his dreams of doom, should come to pass."
"Where is the Dweller now?" Harry demanded. He glanced around at Lardis. "Wolf's son, did you call him? And where's his mother?"
"His mother?"
Lardis raised his slanted eyebrows, quickly lowered them again.
"Ah, his mother. Your wife, the most gentle Lady Brenda."
Harry nodded. "She was my wife once."
"Come this way," said Lardis.
He led the necroscope across the garden, and Harry saw for himself how great were the changes, for it was plain now that the place had been left unattended. Pools were stagnating, the greenhouses were empty and cold, a bitter wind blew, bouncing wiry balls of tumbleweed across the flat, once fertile saddle. And to one side, where the level ground began to climb again like foothills to the higher peaks, there lay Brenda's simple cairn. Harry felt the poignancy of the moment and reached out with his dead speak. It was instinct, like the beat of his heart, like breathing. But in another moment, remembering how she'd been, he withdrew. She wouldn't know him. Even if she did remember, it would only disturb her. To Lardis he said, "She died peacefully."
"Aye," the gypsy answered. "Sun up and gentle rain and all the flowers in bloom. A good time to go."
"She wasn't ill?" Lardis shook his head.
"Merely frail. It was her time."
Harry turned away. "But alone, here?"
"She wasn't alone," Lardis protested. "The Trogs loved her, my travellers too, and her son. He stayed with her to the end. It helped keep his own trouble at bay."
"His trouble?" Harry repeated him. "You mean when he's not himself, not lucid? And you've called him Harry Wolfson. I ask you one more time, where is the Dweller, Lardis Ledisky?" The gypsy stared at him a moment, then glanced at the full moon riding the peaks and shivered.
"Up there," he said. "Where else? Wild as his brother, I am like a king among them, where they lope in the trees along the ridges, or snug in a cave with his bitch on the sunside when the sun is up, or hunting foxes in the far west. Men see him from time to time with the pack. They know him from the hands he wears where the rest have paws, and from his crimson eyes, of course."
Harry need ask no more, for now he knew. It was something he'd wondered about often enough. Almost to himself, softly he said, "With the Dweller, changed, and the Vampiri defeated, no longer a threat. There was nothing to keep his people here. Nothing to hold them together. Perhaps you even feared him, and so you travellers have drifted back to Sunside. The Trogs have returned to their caves, and the garden will soon come to an end, unless I put it to rights again."
"You?"
"Why not? I fought for it upon a time." Lardis's voice was sour, gruff now.
"And you will also hunt on Sunside, hunt men, women, and children, when the nights are dark."
"Does my son hunt the travelling folk? Did he ever?" Lardis turned abruptly away.
"I have to go. At the back of the saddle there's a track, a cleft, a pass. My route back through the mountains to Sunside.
Harry followed close behind. "Do you go alone? Why did you come here anyway?"
"To remember what was upon a time, and to see what has become. Just this one last time."
"And now that the Vampiria no more, how goes it on Sunside? Have you settled, or do you journey as before?" Lardis looked back and gave a snort.
"What? The Vampiri no more? Well, perhaps for now. But the swamps boil with their spawn. All is as it was in the long ago. And what has been will be again. Vampires today, Vampiri tomorrow."
Harry came to a halt, let the other stride away into a rising mist. "Lardis," he called after him. "Remember this. Don't bother me. I won't bother you and yours. That's a promise. And if you're in need, seek me out. Except, seek carefully."
"Huh,"
the gypsy's reply rang from the mist.
"But you're Vampiri now, Harry Hellander. What, and you do make promises? And should I believe them? Well, perhaps I would have believed them upon a time. But believe the thing inside you? No way, never. Oh, you'll come a-hunting soon enough, for a woman to warm your bed, or a sweet traveller child, when you've wearied of the flesh of rabbits."
"Lardis, wait," Harry growled after him. "There are things I need to know, which you can tell me." Of course, he could always stop him instantly, and do what he would with him, but he wouldn't for the old times, and also because he, the Necroscope, was still ascendant, still in command of himself. The moon raced full and low in the sky. It silvered the peaks, turned the shadows of the crags black, made the mist luminous where it crept. And Harry saw that the mist wasn't rising but falling, down from the shadowed places to fill the saddles and false plateaus and tumble over the crags like glowing slow-motion waterfalls. The howl of a wolf reverberated, echoing from one peak to the next. It was joined by another and another. No natural mist, this, and these unseen creatures, they were strange and mournful. Finally, Lardis's voice came back hoarse and panting.
"Do you hear that, Harry Hellander? The Grey Brotherhood? Aye, and their king with them, come to sit by his mother and talk with her a while, as is his wont. Ask him these things, you would know, and maybe he'll talk to his father, too. But as for me, farewell."
There came a distant crunching of pebbles, the sound of scree dislodged and sliding, and Lardis was off and running on his way to Sunside. And the howling ceased. Harry waited. Finally they came out of the mist, long-eared, grey-furred, tongue-lolling, with eyes like molten gold, a pack of wolves. But they were only wolves. Harry looked at them and they looked back. He was unafraid and they were cautious. They lined up on both sides of him and left a gauntlet for him to run. Except he wouldn't run, but walk it. Back to the dweller's house. And as he went, the mist and the Grey Brotherhood closed in behind him. Inside the house, all was darkness, which mattered not at all to the Necroscope. Mist swirled ankle-deep like something sleeping, whose dreams Harry disturbed by passing through. The dweller sat upright at a table in what was once a living room, where the moonbeams came slanting through an open window. He wore a hooded robe, with his eyes burning like triangular coals within the cowl. Only his hands, long and slender, were otherwise visible. Harry sat down opposite, and...
"I had thought you might come back one day,"
said the dweller, his voice a snarl, a cough, a croak.
"And I knew it was you, from the moment you came howling out of the sphere gate. Someone who comes into a place like that, brash and full of fire, he is either fearless or very afraid, or he doesn't much care one way or the other."
"I didn't much care," said Harry. "Not then."
"Let's not waste words,"
said the dweller.
"Once I had all the power, but I also had a vampire in me, and thought you would try to exorcise and kill it, and so kill me. being afraid of what you might do, I put a thought into your head and used it like a knife to cut out all your secret talents. Like me, you could come and go at will. I immobilized you. Like me, you listened to the dead and talked to them. I made you deaf and dumb. And when all was done, then I returned you back to your own place and stranded you there. Not so terrible. At least, you were in your own world, among your own kind. Then for a while there was peace in the world, and to a lesser extent, there was also peace in me. But I had used the power of the sun itself to destroy the Vampiri. You and I together, we had burned them with bright sunfire and toppled their eyries down onto the plain. All very wonderful, but in so doing, in playing with the sun like that, I too had been burned. Well, I would soon recover from it. So it seemed. I did not recover. What started as a healing process soon stopped, indeed reversed itself. My metamorphic vampire flesh could not replenish itself and the flesh of my human body, and the vampire must come first. That which was human in me gradually sloughed away, eaten out, as by leprosy or some monstrous cancer. Even my mind was erased and in large part replaced, and what was instinct in my vampire gradually became instinct inherent in me.